Hey, everybody, it's Kai Rizdahl.
And I am Molly Wood, and welcome to Make Me Smart, the podcast about tech, the economy, the culture, the apocalypse already in progress. Yeah. Nice. None of us are as smart as all of us. Listen, man, you gotta like, this is a dark humor situation. We know that your lives are upended. Ours are upended. Everybody is sort of in this deeply unexpected boat all together, whatever version of that you're experiencing. And so we just want to acknowledge that right off the top, because that's what we're going to be talking about for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, for sure. Today, we're doing education and we're doing distance learning and what that's going to mean for not just parents and kids, but honestly, kind of society writ large, right? Because my kids are out of school. Molly, your kids are out of school, right?
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah, your kids. Sorry.
I mean, something like 70% of all the schools in the United States, I believe, are closed at this point. Right. It is totally unprecedented.
Yep. And there will be side effects for a good long while, both for the parents and for the kids, and maybe, I don't know, for the education system. What do you think? Maybe?
I do. I mean, I think we're going to see so many things. I mean, I'm just going to give you an example of a text that I got from my brother today, because my sister-in-law is a teacher and he has a 7-year-old. And he said that his wife, my sister-in-law, the teacher, is doing a Zoom online class with all of her kids in third grade at a public school. His daughter is doing Google Classroom with her teacher and classmates. We're sort of in this weird, on the one hand, golden age of technology and teaching. However, we know that there are major equity issues. Not everybody has access to tools for remote learning, let alone what happens to schools if they have to be closed for a really long time and students can't get access to, in some cases, food and shelter, right, which they also rely on schools for. So it's a lot.
It is a lot. And we should just declaim right up here at the top. So Molly's been in a home studio forever. I am what I have taken to calling Marketplace North, which is a spare room in my house.
You cannot have that.
You're Marketplace Far North. And our guest is, I think, in his house where there's like a gardener nearby and his daughter's home studying and all kinds of stuff. Pedro Noguera is a distinguished professor of education at the Graduate School of Education and Information Studies at UCLA. Professor, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be with you both.
So, can you give us an idea, just from your perspective, what you know right now, what is happening with colleges and universities and this sort of wave of closures that is moving across the country? What are you hearing in terms of how many schools are closed and how many kids are affected?
So I've been following it, and it started out with a trickle, just a few universities last week. And UCLA, we announced last week classes would end on, at least stop meeting formally, last Tuesday, and now we're seeing it across the country, everybody going online, and we're now seeing that happen in K-12 public schools as well.
Okay, so now what happens? I mean, we have millions and millions of kids across this country out of school. Parents still have to work. Not everybody is equipped with the right technology, with the right infrastructure. This seems like a recipe for yet more inequality in education in this country.
Yeah, we've known for a long time that we had this digital divide, which was just another way of talking about the fact that there are large numbers of people who don't have computers at home, especially kids, and who don't even have internet access where they live. And that's true in many rural areas. It's true in lots of cities like Los Angeles. It's estimated almost half the kids don't have internet access at home. So when you rely on virtual learning as a way to make up for inability to meet in school, you're really leaving lots of kids out. Now in Los Angeles, they're trying to make up with getting local television stations, public TV, to play a role. You know, that may take some time to get up to speed. And I'm not sure if that'll be possible in many other parts of the country.
Well, and there isn't any kind of sort of standardized technology for every school to just plug into, right? They're using a patchwork of sort of private companies and whatever each school or system can or district can cobble together, right?
Yeah. My daughter's school and UCLA are using Zoom. I know some are using Skype, and anybody who's used these before know there's sometimes issues, there's glitches in the connection, and often people have trouble getting online. So it's not a foolproof system at all. And we don't know what's going to happen with the infrastructure when millions of people are on there at once. So this is an unknown territory we're in. Mm-hmm.
Do you think there's a role for regulators here? And I will grant you that, you know, regulation in this country takes forever. But if there's one thing we've seen with this crisis, it's that time is not a luxury we have. So do you suppose there's a way that the Federal Communications Commission, Department of Education, I don't even know who, could step in and say, listen, you got to do it this way?
Well, you know, it would be helpful if we got some clear guidance on what to do and what medium to use for this. It would have even been more helpful if we had seen this coming or recognized a long time ago that access to the internet is vital for everyone, just for safety and for security. And we took the steps to ensure that. We're behind the curve on that. So in the short term, the best we can do is to give good, reliable information. And that hasn't been forthcoming either. I mean, I do want to not criticize the governors and mayors. I think they're doing as best they can. But I do think that there's still a lack of consistent information about the best ways to communicate. Many school districts are struggling on their own to get their teachers up to speed. And so this is uncharted territory, and we're going to see lots of stumbles along the way.
Yeah, I mean, I really, you know, one of the things we've been talking about is sort of the state of the safety net. And this really seems to show some of those cracks really strongly. You have teachers who are underpaid and have been on strike just in recent months. You have private schools that are able to say, you know, oh, they put Zoom on all the kids' iPads, and public schools where they're trying to do Chromebook distribution without exposing more kids potentially to, and their parents, to actual infection. Like, long term, depending on how long this all lasts, do you think that this could expose some of those divides in a way that gets us to do something about it?
Well, I think it has already. We've known for a long time that public schools play a vital role in the social safety net for children in this country. Over half the kids in this country qualify for free or reduced lunch. Mm-hmm. And for those kids, many of them rely on school for basic nutrition, because it's not just lunch, it's breakfast for many kids. When schools close, they don't have access. And we know that that means that we're going to see more kids not eating regularly. So the stability that schools provide to kids is so critical to their development. And we know now that many kids are even more vulnerable because schools are closing. So this is a huge problem that we are not prepared for.
I was having a text exchange with my boss earlier today about this. How long do you think the effects of, and let's just call them the next 2 months, how long do you think those effects ripple through this economy? Because you'll have kids who have lost basically a semester of school.
It's hard to measure at this point, because we don't know, again, how long, and we don't, hard to, you know, what parents can do to make up. If parents could keep their kids reading and keep them intellectually engaged at home, then, you know, the gap in learning is probably going to be negligible. But for those parents who don't have the means or resources or time to do so, the kids are going to fall further behind. We've known for a long time, for example, that the kids who are in enriched learning environments in the summer come back to school in the fall way ahead of the kids who've been sitting at home playing video games or just not involved in any kind of meaningful learning. And we're going to see those kinds of gaps in learning opportunities grow.
I don't want to catastrophize, but, you know, there was an article in the New York Times yesterday that suggested that this is something, the coronavirus disruption particularly may really come and go, that lockdowns may come and go until there is a vaccine. And I wonder if we are talking about, you know, one summer, one semester's worth of learning loss or multiple.
Yeah, that's what we don't know. I mean, some people are saying that the virus could easily come back again next winter, when it might go dormant in the summer and come back. And so these kinds of interruptions, we just don't know how long they'll last and how frequently they'll occur. And so I think now is the time to begin to make sure that we are building the infrastructure so that all kids have access to virtual learning opportunities. For many communities, the public library was a place people would turn to if they didn't have access at home. We've closed libraries because those are places where disease could spread. So we need an alternative arrangement. And that's not even talking about the large numbers of people, especially here in California, who are homeless mm-hmm. and their children. What do they do? So there are big gaps that we haven't thought through.
Our conversation so far, Professor, has been sort of by implication mostly about K through 12. Let me take a very quick turn toward higher education and colleges and universities. And what role they, first of all, what's the impact there? And then what role might they have in facilitating some kind of technology transfer, best practices? Take your pick.
Well, universities, I think they're first and foremost focused on their students, their staff, making sure that they can stay in operation. After all, they are charging people to go to school, but they're not in school. They were learning from home. And their ability to stay afloat at a time like this is going to be challenged, I think, pretty quickly if students stop paying fees and the finances start to make it impossible to keep normal operations. So I think that's what they're primarily focused on. How do we keep operations going during this very uncertain and unstable period? Beyond that, to the degree that they are stable and able to carry out their primary function, then I think they could also play a role in supporting the broader community and in terms of making some of their resources available. They, you know, universities have lots of information. They have libraries. They have, you know, vast resources in terms of their faculty that could be helpful to schools throughout the country. And you know, there are a lot of teachers struggling, okay, what do I provide to kids? And universities could help with that in terms of resources and curriculum. But again, we're doing this on the fly. Yeah. I've seen parents posting, this is what I'm doing with my kid for the day. It would be helpful if we got, say, the State Department of Education, send out a plan. This is a good way to use, to organize the day for your child so that kids are not spending too much time playing video games. So we have to get in front of this pretty quickly.
Yeah, I can tell you that at this moment, my child, according to the schedule that we made, is supposed to be having his hour of academic time before he has a break for creative time. And I'm just hoping that's happening upstairs. Professor Pedro Noguera is a distinguished professor of education at the Graduate School of Education and Information Studies at UCLA. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Pedro. See you.
I mean, I, for one, am amazed that no one's children came in or otherwise intruded on that recording, considering that all three locations had yeah. kids from home. And it doesn't, you know, we should make it clear. I think this affects people, even whether you have kids or don't have kids. Yeah. Like, this is obviously very acute for parents who are home, but it also is changing the way, you know, if you are in a workplace and you're doing remote meetings, you will find that, like, schedules are harder to juggle if some have kids and some don't. I mean, it really is like, this is a massive, it's a massive social disruption. Like the professor pointed out so well, it's a huge safety net issue. And it really could have some long-term impacts.
Yeah. And here's the other thing. This is early days yet. I mean, you know, we're on, you know,
stay
like
two.
Week, what? Two, day two, you know, whatever it is. And it's a little bit overwhelming. So, you're not the only one who's overwhelmed, because honestly, I am. I'm sure Molly
is. I have
is.
A tip. I have
yeah,
a tip
what?
For you, actually, that could be sort what? Of helpful. Well, grandparents, it certainly in California, as we know, in Northern California specifically, we're on this shelter in place, and people over 65 have really been advised not to go out. But grandparents have a lot of information and are stuck at home and can't see grandkids. And so what we've been doing is, like, my son's grandmother knows Spanish really well. And so we're doing like hour-long video chats where she helps him with Spanish homework and does some teaching. But also they get to hang out, which is really sweet.
That's cool. That's cool.
That's just my like pro tip, pro family tip for things to do when your kids are home.
Here for you in your hour of need.
It wasn't my idea, but it's a really good idea.
Yeah, no, it's good. And look, fundamentally, that's what this podcast is all about, right? All of us helping each other through a now incredibly difficult time. But, you know, it's not about us. It's about you. Send us your voice memos and your emails. Make me smart at marketplace.org. Tell me what's happening in your life, how you're coping, by the way. I would be interested in that. Let us know. Bye.
We're here for you. We're a community. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everyone. Let's, I don't even know where to start with a news fix, honestly. We talked about just throwing away the whole show and just having some kind of conversation about what is happening. But, you know, I think there are sort of a few specific things on our mind. In Kai's case, one really large thing.
Well, we're in a recession. We are in a recession. That's not me, and it's not, Treasury Secretary Mnuchin saying, I don't think we're going to get there on the weekend shows this weekend. We're there. UCLA Anderson School, another plug for UCLA, by the way, which, full disclosure, I have a kid for whom I'm paying tuition, but who is not actually on UCLA's campus right now. The UCLA Anderson School forecast came out the other day and said, oh, yeah, it's here. It's already started. We have started this recession, and I am so gobsmacked by the speed of this thing. It amazes me. It truly staggers me. You know, that's it. That's really all I wanted to say. We're in a recession, so it's here. Get used to it. And the question now is, what does the recovery look like? Is it, and imagine this in your mind, right? Is it V-shaped? Is it U-shaped? That is to say, it goes down and bumps along the bottom for a while and then comes back up. Or is it L-shaped, which is kind of what the Great Recession was, right? It went down and then stayed there for a good long while. So that's that.
I do not mean to chastise, but I will say,
what
we have yet to even feel, to even see what it feels like, right?
No.
Like, I'm not ready to talk about recovery, man. Like, but what does it look, what are the layoffs going to look like? What are the furloughs going to look like? What are the, you know, what are look, the immediate impacts?
They're going to be huge. This economy,
they're going to be huge.
I started writing an op-ed about this and I just got too depressed. The thing is, we don't actually have the words for what is happening, right? Because when you're in business and economic journalism, you know what to do when the economic when the economy slows down. You can call it a slowdown or a rough patch, or things are getting soft, right? And then when it's a recession, you've got a recession, you know what that is. And then when there's a great recession and it all goes to hell, you could say, holy cow, we had a financial crisis and a great recession. What's happening now is that the economy is actually stopping. It's just, it's gone from 60 to a brick wall. Boom. And we don't have the words for that. That's it.
We really don't. And I think there's probably no language even for what recovery looks like. We've been phrasing it as a reset.
Yeah.
I mean, this is like that thing where you turn your computer off and you turn it back on again and you hope it still works. Like, we've turned our economy off.
Yeah, but it's going to be different, right? Because 9.99 times out of 10, you turn your computer off and you turn on and everything is there and working, everything's fine, and it's reset. What's going to happen when this economy resets is that there are restaurants and small shops and sundry places in your hometown that will not be there when this economy opens back up again. They just won't.
Yep.
You know, and we can talk till the cows come home about the government sending everybody $1,000 check or a $2,000 check. And that's great. And that will make those employees who are out of work, it'll let them be able to pay their rent. It'll let the landowners or the business owners, you know, maybe, I don't know, like pay people a little bit, whatever. But it's not going to be able to cover rent for as long as it's going to take to get this economy back up. And that's the real challenge. There are entire businesses that are going to be wiped out. Full stop.
Yeah. And potentially sectors. I mean, it really, like, it is, it's, we can't, I don't, it is not our goal on the show to instill panic at all. It's mainly like, it feels like we only have this one thing to focus on. And this one thing containing the spread of this virus and treating the people who are going to get sick and worse is a thing that has to be focused on. Every other issue that already exists in our society just got worse. And so it's, you know, it's incumbent on sort of everyone to also keep their eye on all those other things. Believe me when I say it can get exhausting. I have to, just as a side note, I've been really happy to see how many like feelings are floating around our office all of a sudden. I'm sure it's driving you crazy, but it's really nice to.
That's my favorite part.
It is. Kai just wants to give everybody. He wants to have Zoom happy hours. Like, he's the guy. No, I'm just kidding. It is on the plus side. I have heard from so many friends. I have contacted so many friends. Like, people are really trying to support each other in ways both large and small, and it's good.
Yeah.
On the news version of that, the internet's largest social networks, I find this is sort of the question we've been asking on tech is sort of like, what are the path dependencies that we are creating right now that are going to show how many things could have been happening and weren't?
Right.
Or
right.
will continue to happen. There will be no going back, right? Like one simple example is, two simple examples, data caps on your internet connection.
Mm-hmm.
For years, nigh on a decade, maybe longer, one of the arguments, in fact, against net neutrality has been that internet service providers need to impose data caps. Otherwise, the internet will just simply not function. We do not have the capacity to support everyone
right,
at once.
Right. And now?
Yesterday, I did a little Twitter poll because most of the major ISPs in America have lifted their data caps. And I said, hey, mm-hmm. everybody, how's your internet working? Now, I will grant you, and I mentioned this on the tech show, that if their internet was down, they couldn't have answered my Twitter poll. But the vast, vast majority of people who responded said it's fine. Right? So like ISPs are not going to continue to have a revenue stream around charging overages based on data caps because we will have proven unconditionally that the internet infrastructure does not need them. Simple example. We're also about to see how much social networks can actually do when it comes to managing misinformation on their networks. They've been telling us that it's really hard to curb misinformation. It's hard to crack down on hate speech or political propaganda because of the sheer scale of things. Now, Facebook, Google, LinkedIn, Microsoft, Reddit, Twitter, YouTube have all issued this joint statement saying, we are going to come together to combat fraud and misinformation about coronavirus, elevate real content instead of fake news, share critical updates. And so we're about to find out, I think, in some ways, what could have been happening, yes, but also what can happen when they come together swiftly and do the right thing.
Amen.
That's my fix.
And yes.
Also, subplot to the apocalypse, everybody's buying bidets. Just saying. Oh.
Okay.
Nailed it. On a lighter note.
Okay, then. What? Is that the happy place thing?
We got the happy place thing. Happy place, clean hynes, virgin edition.
Okay.
Just saying. There's a little tiny bit of good in everything.
Oh, my God. All right. So moving right along, as one does in this podcast. Sorry, got to wipe my nose because it's 42 degrees here in my little bungalow. I'm sure you guys can see this blanket I've got on my lap. Anyway, every day we do this, but we do it in a much shorter format on our, I'm going to say, the Echo device skill. So tell your Echo device to make me smart. Check it out. It's me and Molly talking about... Oh, man, everything. Many of them these days, coronavirus adjacent. Molly's doing remote learning today, right? Is that right?
I believe so. Mm-hmm.
All right, good. Good. I have yet to track mine, but that's a whole different thing. Anyway.
Same. So yes. I don't know. I'm going to say yes, definitely.
I'm doing mine right after
Thank
this.
You, Erica anyway. Phillips.
Yes. So tell your thing on your countertop there that's always listening to make you smart, and check it out. Well, let's hit the mailbag.
Let's do it.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
So last week, we heard from our friend Matteo in Italy. He sent us a voice memo around March 1st. He very endearingly told us to come visit. And we said, oof, buddy, because Italy is now up to almost 30,000 cases. The country is under a full lockdown. Deaths are rising at a terrifying rate. And we called him back to hear how things are going. He said, it's been really confusing to deal with conflicting reports and opinions on how bad things are or how severe the closure should be. He said he's someone who can work from home, so he considers himself lucky. But for those who can't, accepting this quarantine is a lot more difficult. Here he is.
I guess the acceptance of this condition also depends on the working condition of everybody. The cases keep growing, the deaths keep growing. The numbers do not compare with those in China. There is something fundamentally different because we have a far larger incidence of death cases. Last time I checked, around 8% instead of 2.5% that happened in China is, I believe, particularly tough on Italians because we need to touch, to hug, we kiss. So that's part of the culture, to feel the other person. I think the main takeaway of my experience is start taking this seriously as early as possible. Start avoiding social contacts. Take this seriously. Don't believe to the politics, to the to the changes in opinion one day to the next. Start taking this seriously. Please do come to Italy when this thing is finished. Ciao.
Yes to both of those. Yes to both of those. Take this seriously and go to Italy. That's it.
Yeah.
It's tough, man. It's really hard.
I know. Thank you, Matteo, and stay safe.
Yes. So New York City now, which, as we know, thrives on art and performance and a lot of creativity. Artists, of course, are some of the hardest hit right now, right? Broadway is shut down. There's all kinds of stuff going on. But you're stuck at home with nothing to do. You can make some art, right? Here's Emily Casey.
Hi, Make Me Smart. This is Emily in New York City. I'm calling in. Nope, that's my dog, to talk coronavirus. So I'm an actor and a musician and a writer. And I do lots of gigs. I have my yoga certificate. I work at a studio and have private clients. I teach music lessons to moms and babies. Lots of things like that that are not happening currently. And I don't know when they're going to start happening again. I'm not sure exactly what to do. And I don't think any of us in my position quite are. It's easy to sort of say, like, we're screwed and we're broke and we're poor and we always were, but that's not very productive because here we are. And maybe the direction to go quiet is one that's less fear-driven and more creatively driven. And maybe it's the artist's time to shine. And perhaps we end up making more money this way. Just out here trying to keep the barometer closer to faith than fear. Have a great one.
That's a good line, keeping the barometer closer to faith than fear. I like that. That's good.
I was just going to say, can I nominate a t-shirt?
Oh, yeah.
That is a really, really good one, and I love that. And you really are seeing some pretty, like, my friend has a personal trainer who she's been raving about for a year. You know, this lady's so great. Yeah. She healed me. She fixed my back, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, I'm sure that sounds lovely, but she's in San Francisco. I'm never going. Well, this woman, this trainer, who is, you know, 24 years old. She's been a personal trainer with a master's for like a year and a half. She is on the hustle. She has like taken to Instagram with all these videos and said, I am open for business. I am now taking new clients via FaceTime.
Wow.
And she's doing these remote training sessions. And I was like, well, dang, I'm going to hire your trainer at long last. I'm going to get a little prison body while I'm stuck here in the house. I mean, I've been in the house for like 3.5 years. I don't know what I'm talking about. If I don't have it yet, it's not going to happen. Now,
I was just going to say.
Anyway, the entrepreneurs are having their moment.
Are hustling.
In a lot of ways, yeah.
Yep, for sure.
Now let's hear from Washington State, which is one of America's extreme epicenters of this outbreak, with a response. Here's listener Krista Kaiser.
Hi, Kai and Molly. My name's Krista. I live in Redmond, Washington. Kind of at the epicenter of the U.S. coronavirus outbreak, and things have been interesting here. There's not very much left at Costco. There's no traffic. It's certainly been a huge change. I'm a freelance user researcher. I contract with mostly tech companies, and I've already noticed in the past couple weeks a little bit of a slowdown in demand for the work that I do. I'm the breadwinner, so I'm a little worried. My university also closed down. I go to University of Washington. Overall, things are really quiet and slow, and I feel not anxious about the outbreak, but I know this is, like you said, just the very beginning.
Yeah, for sure.
On that idea of keeping the barometer closer to faith than fear, mm-hmm. I wonder... One of the things that's hard about this is not everybody is on the same page with respect to the seriousness. I think I can say that mildly. I'm going to put that mildly. We have talked about, you know, what's it going to take to get everybody on the same page? And sometimes I joke it's an alien invasion, but humans would still find a way to fight. And so I wonder what people are doing to both take it seriously and keep their mental health afloat. I think there's a very human tendency to say, I don't want to think about how bad this could get because that will send me into a depression.
Yeah.
I think it's a real challenge. It's a real struggle to find that balance.
No, I think that's right. I think honestly, and in all seriousness, mental health is going to be a real challenge the next, you know, however long it is in this economy, in this society, that's for sure. Okay. We will send you off with the Make Me Smart question, as we always do. This one is not coronavirus related at all. It comes to us from Eleanor Gordon Smith. She is a writer, a radio producer, also an author. Her book is called Stop Being Reasonable, How We Really Change Our Minds. And here's her answer to the Make Me Smart question. What is something you thought you knew but then found out you were wrong about?
I thought I knew that we were right to put as much stock as we do in debate and the rigorous clash of ideas. I mean, I really, really took it to be true. It was like a bedrock part of my personality. I thought, you know, whatever else went wrong in a democracy, speaking to each other freely and openly was both a safeguard and a pretty reliable path to the truth. And then two things changed for me. One was that I read a fantastic book by a philosopher named Miranda Fricker called Epistemic Injustice. She argues that you can say all the right words, you can make the good arguments, you can present all the evidence properly, but sometimes something about who you are stops those words from really landing. It could be your gender or your class or your race, but there's something that means that your words aren't taken as seriously as other people's. And the second thing that changed for me was that I made a radio program for This American Life, where the premise was when men catcalled me on the street, I would stop, I would turn around, and I would try to persuade them to stop doing it. And I spent hours talking to dozens of men, and I recorded all these conversations, basically just telling them, listen, women don't like this. And over again, they'd push back and they'd say things like, you can't speak for all women. And I started to realize that phenomenon that Miranda Fricker describes is happening to me now. If a male friend was saying these same words to them or making the same points to them that I'm making, things would be different. And it made me realize in quite a sad, defeating sort of way that words just aren't standardized currency. And some words, just like some speakers, arrive in the arena of debate already less powerful than their opponents. And if that's the case, then words are the things that are subject to the very same warpings in power that we wanted to use them to solve. So I went from thinking that I really knew how important the clash of words was, and you know, I knew that it was good that we continue to debate each other and speak in this rigorous way, to really feeling like I don't know anymore when, or indeed if, that's helpful.
This is so painfully, profoundly relevant to what I just said about the taking seriously of the moment. That it is so difficult in this time when all the information is conflicting, right? When there is not a sort of single source saying, this is what you need to do. Whether that, you know, in some cases, that's like the mayor of a town not showing up the way that other city officials are, or, you know, cities officials are, or it's from the federal government. But like everybody is sort of trying to have this argument and this conversation and say, this is what you need to take seriously. And these are the people you need to listen to, but it doesn't really matter because like you either are or not. And it's about agency and expertise and institutions and authority. It is so messy. And it's like, anyway, yes, that was a long answer to a long answer. Agree. Yeah,
that's right. So there you go.
Yes. She said. All right. Before we go, a reminder. We do have the Make Me Smart newsletter that is still happening every Friday in your inbox. And there's a Marketplace daily newsletter that has also been retooled to really keep you up to date on what we're doing, what's happening in the economy, what's happening around coronavirus. Both of them are, I'm going to say, essential reading. Marketplace.org/newsletters. Go sign up.
Please.
And that's it.
You know, that's it. Just sign up.
Also, it's free. It's all free. None of our stuff is behind a paywall. Just throwing that out there.
That's true.
Make Me Smart is produced and directed.
But please donate to your local public radio station, might I just say.
Oh, yeah. Definitely donate.
There you go.
So that someone else can consume important public service journalism for free. Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Sam Anderson. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner, and our senior producer is Jody Becker. Thanks to our video producer, Ben Hethcote, and our video intern, Ethan Peretz. And thanks to writer-producer, Erica Phillips, on the newsletter beat.
This week's program was engineered by Daniel Ramirez. Our theme music was composed by Daniel Ramirez and Ben Holiday. The executive director of On Demand is Tar Nieves, and the senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark. And there we go. It's like a triple remote podcast.
We are in a golden age of technology.
Kind of is.
And that may be the only saving grace that we have right now. Huh? All right. Bye.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.